Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sri Govardhana Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare. So we're not chanting responsively, right? I just read the verse and pick up where you left off in the purport. Is that correct? Okay. So, of course, Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Shmaranam Parasevanam Artanam Bandaram Dasyam Sakyam Atmanivedanam Iti Pumsharpita Vishnu Bhaktis Chain Navalakshana Kriyeta Bhagavati Adha Tanmanye Ditam Uttamam. And there's a place here where the posted is. Grihastha devotees must adopt the Archanavidhi or deity worship according to the suitable arrangements and directions given by the spiritual master. Regarding those unable to take to the deity worship in the temple, there is the following statement in the Agni Purana. Any household or devotee circumstantially unable to worship the deity must at least see the deity worship, and in this way he may achieve success also. The special purpose of deity worship is to keep oneself always pure and clean. Grihastha devotees should be actually examples of all cleanliness. Deity worship should be continued along with hearing and chanting. Therefore, every mantra is preceded by the word Namaha. In all the mantras, there are specific potencies of which the Grihastha devotees must take advantage. There are many mantras preceded by the word Namaha, but if one chants the holy name of the Lord, he receives the result of chanting Namaha many times. By chanting the holy name of the Lord, one can reach the platform of love of Godhead. One might ask, then, what is the necessity of being initiated? The answer is that even though the chanting of the holy name is sufficient to enable one to progress in spiritual life to the standard of love of Godhead, one is nonetheless susceptible to contamination because of possessing a material body. Consequently, special stress is given to the Archanavidhi. One should therefore regularly take advantage of both the Bhagavata process and the Pancharitaka process. Deity worship has two divisions, namely pure and mixed with fruitive activities. For one who is steady, deity worship is complementary. Observing the various types of festivals such as Janmashtami, Ram Navami, and Narsingha Chaturdasi is also included in the process of deity worship. In other words, it is compulsory for householder devotees to observe these festivals. Now let us discuss the offenses in deity worship. The following are offenses: to enter the temple with shoes or being carried on a palanquin, to not observe the prescribed festivals, to avoid offering obeisances in front of the deity, to offer prayers in an unclean state, not having washed one's hands after eating, to offer obeisances with one hand, to circumambulate directly in front of the deity, to spread one's legs before the deity, to sit before the deity while holding one's ankles with one's hands, to lie down before the deity, to eat before the deity, to speak lies before the deity, to address someone loudly before the deity, to talk nonsense before the deity, to cry before the deity, argue before the deity, to chastise someone before the deity, to show someone favor before the deity, to use harsh words before the deity, to wear a woolen blanket before the deity, to blaspheme someone before the deity, to worship someone before the deity, to use vulgar language before the deity, to pass air before the deity, to avoid very opulent worship of the deity even though one is able to perform it, to eat something not offered to the deity, to avoid offering fresh fruits to the deity according to the season, to offer food to the deity which has already been used or from which has first been given or which has first been given to others. In other words, food should not be distributed to anyone until it has been offered to the deity, to sit with one's back towards the deity, to offer obeisance to someone else in front of the deity, not to chant proper prayers when offering obeisances to the spiritual master, to praise oneself before the deity, to blaspheme the demigods. In the worship of the deity, these 32 offenses should be avoided. And we get a lot of Mormons, obviously, in Utah. And we have a sign outside the temple that advertises tours every day from 10 in the morning till 7 at night. And so I have various stations that we stop and explain things. Upstairs, if we go upstairs, there's a big picture of the changing bodies. So I call that the reincarnation station. And then we go before Prabhupada. That's the guru station where I explain the role of the guru. And there's a picture, I think it was done by Dhanavir Goswami, of the parampara. So we point that as well. And then we come before the deities. And these are Mormons and these are Christians. And there's all these injunctions against worshiping idols and graven images and so on and so forth. And so not only is there the task of explaining it to them, but also some rather disarming them. So, and Krishna is dark, black. Mormons didn't even allow black people in the church, I think, until about 20 years ago. They had a revelation and all of a sudden decided it was okay. But we picked a black deity because we had joined in Melbourne, and the deity there was Radha Gopi Janavallabha. Radha Vallabha, actually. And so we wanted a black deity. So you have a black deity in a vanilla state, I guess. And so I start off by explaining this is not deity worship. And I was in the room, probably 1972 in Australia, when two Mormon missionaries visited Prabhupada. And they chatted quite cordially for some time. But before they took their leave, one of the boys, and I think he was the newer, younger, you know, kind of greener of the two, he couldn't resist saying, how are we supposed to understand, you know, this statue, this what's going on here? Prabhupada said, how are you supposed to understand it? This is how you worship God. I mean, this is, if you were acknowledging that everything belongs to God, including your home, including your family, your energy, your life, your successes, the things that you've learned, your eternal spiritual self, this is what you would do. We wouldn't be so foolish or superstitious or primitive as to do all this for a symbol or allegorically. You have a covering over the Lord. You don't want him to be uncovered. He's dressed and clothed every single day. He's woken up, suprabhatam. Next time I go to Tirupati, my friend there, he's gone every day for 27 years. He's promised me that we'll go for the awakening of the deity, which occurs at 1:30 in the morning and takes a considerable amount of time. In the same way that a king wakes by hearing bards sing his praises, similarly the Lord is awakened every day by people singing his praises, and he's put to sleep in the same way. Offerings of food, and we don't taste the food before we offer it out of respect for the Lord. This is how you would worship God. This is not how you worship an idol. Nobody in their right mind would go to all that extent to worship an idol. Yeah, I think I'll dedicate myself to worshiping an idol. You know, get up at 1:30 in the morning, and six artis a day, and offerings of food, and dressing the deities, and special dresses, and festivals. Yeah, I think I'll just all do that for an idol. I mean, hello. This is how you worship God. This is how God is worshipped. And as Prabhupada was talking, you know, I could see it was, you couldn't refute it. You know, especially here in Los Angeles, which has the most beautiful deity worship in all of America. I visited Tuaco also a few years ago for a conference, and the building is, I don't even want to say anything about the building. I would, you know, it needs to be replaced. The deities need to be moved to a better building. It's a fire hazard, you know. But there's two devotees there, Shamala. And Damodar, who is, Rishi, Samaka Rishi's son. And I was staying with Shamala and her husband. And it was like a Monday night. And Damodar came over to visit. And they sat around the kitchen table. And for about 2 hours, they talked about how they were going to dress the deity the following day. I mean, every single detail. The color of the flowers, the arrangement of flowers, the placing of the mukhats, every single detail. And when you go to this ramshackle, I don't want to risk offending the abode of the Lord. But, and this isn't Sunday. This isn't like for the public, you know, for the Sunday feast. This is a Tuesday morning, and you walk in there, and you're literally, your breath is taken away by the devotion, you see, and the attention to every single detail that goes into dressing the deity every single day. So Prabhupada said, this is how you worship God. This is not how you worship an idol, or something symbolic. And the Indian people, Prabhupada, on another occasion, I remember he said that, you know, the Indian people are very sophisticated people. They're practically the best computer programs. They represent a big part of the Apple team, the Intel team, the Microsoft team. These people are very sophisticated, very intelligent. They're not going to worship, well, at least, you know, since thousands and thousands of years, things have degraded considerably in the modern times. But for thousands and thousands of years, in tens of thousands of temples, hundreds of millions of people since time immemorial have not gone to that trouble to worship idols. And then Prabhupada did something really, really funny. Prabhupada, he travels around and he notes, you know, devotees point out to him tourist spots and all. In fact, nobody who lives in L.A. is unaware of the Mormon temple right on Santa Monica, right? Right at that intersection, it's like right there. You see what I'm saying? San Diego, as you come in, it's just as you enter the city. So Prabhupada couldn't have failed to notice something. He said, that angel, you know, on the top of your buildings, what, you know, this is how we worship God. What do you call? You're calling, you're inferring, and it was all very polite and cordial, but the inference was that we're worshiping. The inference was that we're doing idol worship. So if we're doing idol worship, Prabhupada said, what do you call it when you put your saint outside to have the pigeons pass stool on him all day long? What is that called? You know. Point taken, I think. So anyway, here I am with the Mormons and we're standing before the deity and I'm explaining this is not imagined, this is not concocted, this is not an idol. God is everywhere. One of the definitions of God is that he's not only in his own transcendental abode, but he's also within each and every atom. There cannot be any place where God is not fully present. Pantashtu koti satavat sarasam pragamyo. There's no place where God is not fully present. Take his birth, for instance. He appeared from the womb of Mother Devaki. He didn't live in there for 9 years of gestation. He didn't develop as an embryo. He appeared from the womb of Devaki, just like the moon appears from the ocean, or at least seems to appear from the ocean. The moon actually has nothing to do with the ocean. It appears as if from the ocean, but actually the moon and the ocean are totally separate things. So Krishna had nothing to do with the womb of Devaki. He had nothing to do with that. He had no contact per se with that on the mundane level. He appeared from the womb of Devaki just like he could appear from here. He could appear from this point in space. He could appear from this point in space. He could appear from this point. He could appear from this point. He could appear because he's already fully present within each and every atom. So he appeared from the womb of Devaki. And I would explain to people that God is, and they're with me, you know, they're pious people. You know, God is everywhere present. There's no place where God is not fully present. And especially, and then I say, having said that, why don't we worship the microphone? Why don't we worship the podium? Why don't we worship the pillar? Because God is especially present according to a covenant and according to the system that Narada Muni enunciated millions and millions of years ago to Lord Brahma. I'm going to just put it so I don't break my teeth on it. He is especially present where he has been carved. His form has been carved according to the extensive descriptions of the scriptures, according to the visions of great purified saints and sages throughout the ages, carved by families who do this generation after generation, observe protocol. When he is invited to take his throne in a certain area and there is an elaborate, often week-long purificatory Pratishthan ceremony where the deity is established, there are covenants made that as long as the local people worship him with cleanliness and punctuality and devotion, and there's always that, we did this in Utah, and I'll never forget as long as I live. It was in 2001 when he had the opening of the temple. We did this in Utah. Ramananda and Dharmashetu came to do the pratishthan, and they had the deities blindfolded, and then they do an abhishekam while the deities are blindfolded. And there's a point there, I actually forget this detail, whether it was before, I think they were bathed and they were dressed, and I think they were still brought out blindfolded, but there was a moment there, and we were packed, we had 5,000 people there. There was a moment there when the blindfolds are taken down. And for the first time, the deities see their devotees, and the devotees see the netram, the eyes of the deity. And it's absolutely unforgettable. It's absolutely unforgettable. And it's meant to make a deep impression, because God agrees, God, the Lord of millions and millions and millions of universes, he agrees to be personally present, not through, you know, Brahma Jyoti. He agrees to be personally present in that place where all these conditions are met, and as an ongoing practice where he's worshipped with devotion and punctuality and cleanliness. God is personally present there. And of course, you've heard a million times the example, I give it to the people. You know, there's boxes on the corners of streets that are orange and blue, and they're marked PMG. And you can put your letter in that box with confidence that it's going to get to its destination. Why? Because it's authorized. It's authorized. So you can worship the deity, the duly installed deity, with confidence that you're worshiping God personally. Personally. Because why? It's authorized. And if there's some teenagers in the crowd, in the tour group, I'll say, and if you ever get if you're ever out, you know, some Saturday night with your friends and you want to do some mischief, don't put cherry bombs, don't get a baseball bat and hit a post office box, because that's not a local offense, that's not a municipal offense, that's not a county offense, that's not a state offense, that is a federal offense. The punishment for doing something to federal, authorized federal property will be far greater than transgressing any local or state laws. So smash something else, but don't smash a post office box, because it's authorized by the U.S. government. And then, of course, then there's the issue of the youth. And I say, you're probably wondering about two things. You're probably wondering about the color of the Lord and the youthful demeanor of the Lord. I say, as far as color is concerned, he's black. Our deity, he's black. And in these pictures, he's more bluish. But actually, he's neither black or blue. The Sanskrit word is sham, which means the color of a monsoon cloud during the rainy season. If you've ever been in an eastern country during the rainy season, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about, the beauty of that. In fact, in 1991, we bought 5 acres of land in 82, and it took us 10 years to pay off the mortgage for that piece of land. And all along, there had been, adjacent to the 5 acres, another 8.5 acres of land with a for sale sign on it. And we didn't have the funds to buy it, and I expected any minute it would be snapped up and, you know, someone build a house and we'd have laundry, you know, and our, you know, hanging on the line or something. Nobody bought this property for 10 years. Nobody bought it. It was the most... Of course, we had a radio tower, and that necessitates an elevated hillock. And then the hillock extended onto this property. What a sight for a house, you know, overlooking the entire South Utah Valley. The most prime piece of property south of Provo. Nobody bought it for 10 years. And we couldn't even think of it because we were paying off the mortgage. But finally, after 10 years, the mortgage was paid off, and there was $1,500 a month staying home. And so it was owned by the Catholic Church. And I called up the Catholic Church and asked them, you know, anyway, that's a whole nother story. Anyway, First, we talked about just buying 1 or 2 acres according to our means. And finally, the realtor for the Catholic Church was a guy named Rick Salvitti, and he comes from Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, which is a little one-horse town 10 miles from the one-horse town that I come from called Stallstown, Pennsylvania. So we got a rapport going on. He says, true. He says, it's going to be too complicated to sell you 1 or 2 acres of this 8.5. So I'll make you a deal. You can buy the whole plot, you know, if you can just scrape up a $25,000 down payment. So we worked and sold cookies and so on and so forth. And thank you, L.A., for all the cookies I sold here. Forever indebted to you. Thank you. We had $17,000, and we needed $8,000 more. And I had a strong feeling that any day, if we don't get in there, put that down payment, and ink the contract, I have a strong feeling that if I don't act right away, that this finally will be literally snapped up right at the 11th hour. So how to get $8,000, you know? I mean, a good day on a cookie sale is like $300, you know? When the Gemcos were closing down in Palm Springs, I had a $900 day. But Gemcos only closed down, you know, once a century. So how to get $8,000? We had a llama. In those days, llama, law of supply and demand. A lot of people wanted llamas. They were rare, so the prices were quite good. I remember we made $80,000 one year selling llamas, and we had a couple of $60,000 years. But the most we'd ever gotten for a female llama was like $4,000. But we had this one llama. Is this Shostrick? I don't. Maybe it's the Srimad Bhagavatam evolving or something, expanding, I don't know. But we had this one llama who was bluish black. She had a bluish black ewe to her, and we'd called her Shamin, which is the feminine for Sham. So there's a very wealthy fellow in the area who owns a string of music stores, and he came to visit us one day, and he said he's in the market to buy a female llama. So we're leaning over the fence there, and there's the whole herd of females, and you know, I'm saying this one is 3, and this one's 4, and this one's 5. And then I just had this, actually I was going to say something less, but Krishna made the words $8,000 come out of my mouth when I pointed to Shamin. $8,000. And he wrote out a check right there. We're on the fence, you know, just a couple of llama wranglers, you know. He writes me out a check for $8,000. So there's some practical experience that I have, and sometimes I'll tell this to the tour group if they seem particularly keen, to underline the fact that, in fact, God is all attractive, and people always ask, well, why is he blue? And I say, well, he's all attractive, and he's blue because he's blue. You know, nothing caused him to become blue. His blueness is not the effect of a previous cause. He's the cause of all causes, so God is blue because he's blue. And he's also the most attractive. And so if you think about it, that's almost what you might anticipate or predict. And then as far as the youthfulness, the default idea of God, my guess is, you know, the old guy on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. I think that's probably what comes to the mind of Westerners. If the greatest artist in all of Western culture spent, I don't know how many years, on his back, you know, with paint dripping into his eyes and all, to paint this, I assume that, you know, he was pretty fixed in that conception. And we can imagine that God is portrayed as being old because old means wise. Every one of us knows that the older we are, the wiser we are. The younger we are, the stupider we are. And also, God's been around a long time. And so old and wise and blah, 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 so paint him as old. But what they overlook is that God is all-powerful. God is all-powerful. That means there's nothing above him. There's no power above him that can force him to do anything he doesn't want to do. We get old because we're not God. We'd rather not, but we're forced to get old because we're not God. And we're in material bodies, and then there's the effect of time on these material bodies. So that brings about agedness. However, time and matter, they are under the control of God. They do his bidding and not the other way around. So they have no power to age him. They have no power to age him. So I don't know who that guy is on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, but he's not God. Prabhupada called that imaginative iconography. using our mundane frog-like mind to try and figure out what God should or would look like. The fact is that he's eternally youthful because there's nothing that can make him otherwise. And then another consideration is, if God can age, what does that mean? What does that mean? What does that mean? Yeah, he can die, right? If you acknowledge, if you seed that point that God can age, then you've also seeded the point that he can die, isn't it? So if you worship a God that ages, then you're also worshiping a God that dies, which is not capital G-O-D. It might be demigod, but it's certainly not capital G-O-D. And so I say, when you really think about it, God would be youthful and beautiful, just as he's omniscient, he's all-knowing, he's omnipotent. Similarly, he would be the most beautiful. He would be the most beautiful. There can be no one more, as there can be no one more knowledgeable than God, no one more powerful than God. Similarly, there can be no one more beautiful than God. And then to lighten things up a little bit, I say, and we believe this is the same God who you worship in the Old Testament. It's just that here he's in a much better mood. So by this time, our nervous, you know, Krishna temple visiting tour group is, you know, they're comfortable. And they go back and they say, it's just like our religion. They believe the same things that we believe. You know, an hour they were standing petrified before this black deity of a god. And an hour later, they said, they believe just like we believe. It's just like our religion. So hopefully some progress has been made. How much time have I talked so far? Huh?
In the first 32 offenses that one should avoid, there's an item under Q which says to show someone favor before the deity. Could you expound on that? To show favor before the deity.
In a sense, the guru is our deity. Prabhupada said there's two aspects of God. There's the worshipable God, and then there's the worshiper God. So the guru is never claims to be God, but because he's a perfect representative of the Lord, he is the worshiper God. In other words, he represents the Lord, just like a viceroy can go travel on behalf of the king in distant lands. He can accept praise for the king. He can accept tribute. He can accept gifts for the king. And as long as he's, you know, situated in his consciousness of doing this on behalf of the king and never thinks that any of this is about him, then he can go on representing the king flawlessly. And the king is perfectly confident. And the king is actually happy when the king sees that his viceroy, or he or hears news that his viceroy is being worshipped very nicely, that makes him very happy. He knows those people are not rebellious. They're going to continue living peacefully, and there won't be any sort of civil wars in the near future. And so he's actually very, very happy when his representative is worshipped very nicely, because that's basically worship for him. We started doing Shivaratri a number of years ago, and it was, I think, a lot more controversial at that time than it is now. But people will say, well, we don't worship demigods. Well, we don't worship demigods as God, obviously. It's funny, the Mormons have a saying, one of their prophets, Lorenzo Snow, he said, as man is, God was, as God is, man will become. So, and they get in a lot of trouble with the other Christians because, you know, in the face of that, that's pretty blasphemous. It's pretty heretical. So I tell them, you know, I think you might have a semantic problem here, you know, because you're using the same word for the capital G-O-D as small G-O-D. And if you were writing it, we would be able to see the difference. But when you speak it, it's the same word. And in fact, they would be the first ones to acknowledge that we can't become G-O-D. But, so I say, I believe that we've kind of solved the problem here by saying as demigod is, man will become as man as demigod was. And so we don't worship Lord Shiva as God. That's blasphemous. But he is a pure devotee. He is a pure devotee. And we actually worship the pure devotees on their special days. And we pray to them. We don't pray to them as God, but we pray to them, what bhakti you have, what seeds of bhakti you have, you please infect me with that. You please bless me. Yasha prasada bhagavad prasadam. In fact, there's a statement, I believe it's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, when Krishnadas Kaviraj left home because Nityananda was overlooked, there's a statement in that section that says, you will not get the fruit of worshiping Lord Chaitanya if you neglect Lord Nityananda. And similarly, it says, you will not get the fruit of worshiping Lord Krishna if you neglect Lord Shiva. So it's not mandatory. I'm not saying it's mandatory or anything like that. But we opted to do that and to get the favor of Lord Shiva. And in the many years that we've been doing it, the participants, the people who have come to the temple, they've definitely felt that we're getting the mercy of a pure devotee to take our worship of Krishna to a higher level. Yes. Archita's hand went up first.
Hi, Bolcharupu. Thank you very much for a nice presentation. I think more directly to Naikatma's point is the question was, why does it say you should not show favor before the deity? I think the point here is that the pujari especially represents Krishna in giving Krishna's mercy to others. But if the pujari starts thinking, I am going to bless you, which they do in many temples that are not strictly under guidance of a pure devotee, they think, I'm going to bless you and therefore you give me remuneration. Just like I went to Puri with my wife at the time and I was approached and they said, she can't come in but you can. All you have to do is give the right bakshish, obviously. So that kind of thing is what they're talking about. You cannot show favor to anybody in front of the deity. You can give the deity's favor to others. You can bless others on behalf of the deity. Like, you know, we give the crown, we give whatever to bless people on behalf of Krishna. But if you start thinking that you're going to bless people, that's an offense.
From that point of view, I can cite two instances. One of which I was a little dubious about and the other one I was grateful for. I went to Sri Rangam a few years ago and got the darshan of the deity, and I just had some bills in my pocket and I just pulled out a bill thinking I was giving, you know, a rupee or 10 rupees or 50 rupees. And kind of dim, it's kind of dim there. There's just a single flame and there were about five or six priests in the area, not immediately in front of me. But I just put a bill there. And then all of a sudden there was this huge commotion. There was this huge commotion and the priests were almost like elbowing each other out of the way, you know, putting each other in headlocks and stuff like that. Because I inadvertently pulled out a 500 rupee note and put it on the plate. So not only they were trying to see who could get the 500 rupee note, but they were all trying to get me to, you know, throw out four more 500 rupee notes for each one of the priests. So that was a little distasteful. And I'm sure that wasn't pleasing to the deity. But on another occasion, my friend took me to Tirupati. And it seems like the last three times I've been there, it's always been on Mahasankranti, where like 300,000 people are visiting the temple. But he has connections, and so we got in within 10 minutes or so. And you know, you've been to Tirupati, probably some of you. They have professional pushers because the deity is so attractive that nobody of their own free will is going to leave. I mean, once you get in front of Balaji, there's no way you're going to walk away voluntarily. So you get pushed. You know, you get pushed, right? So I'm there and I'm expecting my 2 seconds and all. And indeed, you know, instead of getting pushed from this side, priest tapped me on the shoulder and he invited me to go right inside. He invited me to go right inside because I guess I was, you know, Western bodied, and of course I was with my friend. And I said, I gotta have some record of how long I'm in here, right? So I started chanting, Om Sasha Shirsha Purusha Sahasak Sahasapate Sabamam Vishato Vidra Tadishtada. 17 verses of the Purusha Shukta. I chanted 12 verses, a minute and 17 seconds. Yes! Like that. And then we went out. There's 300,000 people. They're waiting in line for 15 hours. And I mean, this is a glaring example of favoritism, but I'm not gonna complain, you know. And my friend, he says, we take darshan of Ugra Nisringa there, Yoga Nisringa, and he says, I want to get darshan again. I said, like a second time? He said, yes, like that. So he says something to the priest, and then there's the brass railing. So they just literally pulled the brass railing. They just pulled it, and we slipped in, and we went and got darshan a second time. So, what can I say? You know, I'm guilty. Being shown favor. Yes.
Explain. It's easy to explain about the deity form in a human form. What about the animal forms? If they say, why do you worship God as an animal? As an animal form.
Krishna does appear in all the different species, fish species, lion species, eagle species. He does appear. Of course, the original, the archetypical Prajapatis that come from Brahma are more human than they are animal, because that's the divine form. That's the God himself has a human-like form. And so even the progenitors of the species themselves are the original ones. I mean, Garuda's got hands as well as wings and all. They're more human-like than they are animal-like. And even if you take a fish or so, instead of arms, they have what do they call those, fins. Instead of legs, they have the back things. You know, everything, even as you find yourself lower and lower on the evolutionary ladder, still there's that semblance of a human form, because that's in fact the highest form. That's God's form. If you take me and you put, you know, 50 blankets over me, then my what's now very distinguishable limbs becomes just little bumps here and there. See what I'm saying? Because of the covering. So as entities are covered with more and more with ignorance, maybe their forms appear less and less similar to that of God. But originally, that's the form from which every other form comes from. And so as you go back in creation, as you go back each stage towards the time of creation, you find that the forms or murtis are more and more human-like. In that connection, I once asked Prabhupada about the species. You know, the scientists say they categorize things in terms of species, and they haven't been to all the planets, so they don't have, you know, they haven't gotten any more species categorized than what are on this planet. But Prabhupada said it's not really species. Sometimes he would use the word species, sometimes we use the word species, but it's not really species. That's not correct. It's murtis. It's murtis. There's 8,400,000 murtis, distinct types of forms throughout the universe. So I don't know whether that answers your question or not, but that's all I know on the subject. Yes.
Hare Krishna. Thank you so much for inspiring deity worship presentation. In regards to that, I have a question. Like, for someone who wants to do the deity worship at home, where is the starting point? Like, most of the cases, like, people think, oh, we may commit some sins, like, without knowing, like, for example, not feeding deity or God. So where is the starting point? Like, where we can start? Is there any qualification to do that? Can you explain that, please?
Api chet saracharo bhajate mamana sadhare vasamantina samyag vivashoita. Says even if one's guilty of 1,000 faults, as long as he's moving forward, as long as they're moving forward, he's to be considered saintly because he's rightly situated. Too often we beat ourselves up over some discrepancy, or maybe other people are willing to jump in there and fault find and point out shortcomings and all like that. But Krishna's not so critical. He's not judgmental. As long as you're hearing and chanting and you're moving forward, God is happy with you. You might be guilty of 1,000 mistakes, 1,000 shortcomings. you might have made a huge relational or financial mistake before you came here this morning. But as long as you're hearing and chanting and moving forward, God is pleased with you. Don't worry about it. You know, God doesn't see you as other people see you. He created you. He's your Father. He loves you. And there's nothing you can really do that's ever going to make Him cut you off. If you neglect hearing and chanting, then you will definitely become removed from Him. And you will definitely have sufferings that will present themselves before you again and again and again and again and again. Because you're not hearing and chanting. You're not learning the lessons that you're supposed to learn to become mature in devotion. God wants you back home, back to Godhead. And any challenges, any things that face us, that's His mercy so we can learn the lesson. So if we're hearing and chanting and doing japa and deity worship to the best of our ability with a sincere heart, and I'm not going to get into, you know, if you missed one offering or, you know, but if you're doing it with a sincere heart, if your heart is right, then you'll learn those lessons in one go and you'll continually advance and continually progress steadily back home, back to Godhead. But if you take it that I don't have to hear and chant, I'm exempt, I can do it my way, then you'll have to learn the same lessons over and over and over and over and over and over again. So just try to do your best. Try to take some simple standard that you can follow and gradually increase upon that. And if you make a mistake or if there's a discrepancy or something, just make sure that you get back into it. You know, you're on the path. You're rightly situated. You're saintly. God's not looking at your faults. He's looking at your progress. Any other questions? Yes.
Because you're going to have trouble.
Get into trouble.
Yeah, if you ask something else with material. But sometimes there are some things in devotional service, in the process, which you want to improve. So what is the best way to ask, or how to ask deities for that? Just with your words, you know, how to approach
God. I have to tell this story. It's kind of related. But because I'm in L.A., I'm very much thinking of my old friend Pranjeevan. And Pranjeevan, he was in Uganda, and he's a quite wealthy person. But Idi Amin, the tyrant, he confiscated all the Indians' land. And so one day he went to the bank, and the teller told him, "I'm very sorry, but all your assets are frozen. All I can do is give you a ticket to England or America." And so Pranjeevan came to America. And it was an unfair situation, but he didn't, you know, have a pity party. He did the best he could to provide for his family. So he had a little kiosk in the ground floor of the Trans-American Life building downtown. And his biggest seller was beef burritos. And at the same time, he started coming to the temple. And on Sundays, he would hear the talks about we're all spirit souls. It's ridiculous that animals don't have souls. Animal means soul. And you get what you give. You know, if you give pain and suffering, then you'll get that boomerang back in your life. If you give respect and compassion, then you'll get that back in your life. And it doesn't just refer to human beings. It refers to all living beings, that God is equally loving of the souls that are in less than human beings as He is. And so he comes to me and he says, "Chiru," he says, "the tension between what he's doing and what he's hearing," he says, "the tension is getting every week I come in here and then I have to go and the tension," he says, "something's got to give." He says, "Either I got to stop coming to the temple or I got to stop selling the beef burritos." But the beef burritos are supporting my family. You know, they're paying the tuition of my son to go to pharmacy school at USC. I mean, how can I stop selling the beef burritos? I said, "Pranjeevan, that's your decision to make." So a few more weeks went by and finally he comes up and he says, "Chiru," he says, "I'm not going to stop going to the temple. It's my life and soul." He says, "Tomorrow morning I'm going to start selling the beef burritos." So the next day he goes to the shop, and of course he's a very friendly fellow, and most of his customers were regulars, and so he knew a lot of things about them, and they really liked, you know, the time when they would come up and buy a little knickknack from him. And so they started ordering beef burritos, as was their custom. And he said, I'm not selling beef burritos anymore. And they said, why not? And he explained it to them. And most of them accepted his decision based on his very, very deep sense of integrity. So instead of ordering beef burritos, and they all started ordering bean burritos. And his business only went down about 5%. It only went down. So because he did the right thing, he did the right thing. It wasn't the convenient thing. But he actually believed in the promises of the Lord, that the Lord will protect those who are surrendered unto him. I mean, this is the same God who causes the sun to rise and set exactly on time, the seasons to change, the planets to fly through the air without crashing each other. It seems like the least we could do is put some faith in his words rather than our mental calculations. And Pranjivan did that. And, of course, he's passed away a few years now, but his son now lives in a big mansion in Diamond Bar. He's got two Mercedes in the driveway. But perhaps more importantly is Ashok, when he bought this house or had it built, he had a huge room built just as a temple room so he could have regular gatherings there in Harinam. So what Pranjivan did to do the right thing as opposed to the convenient thing or the comfortable thing or the obvious thing, what he did obviously blessed him. He was chanting Hare Krishna at the time of leaving his body. And then that blessing even passed down to generation, to his next generation. So I have to stop here. Hey, Bob.